My training, so to speak, in this, it's on. Thank you. I appreciate you reminding me. Don't ever hesitate to remind me. My training in counseling has been entirely through my life at Ananda. I came to Ananda when I was 24 years old, and I've always been living in spiritual community, working, my whole working life since then has been, in one way or another, serving in the context of Ananda. The only time we didn't live in community was our first 2 years when we moved here in 1987, until we were able to get the lease the property where we now have a community. So there's a little interlude, but even then we were involved with the community, we just didn't live in it. So I've always been surrounded by a large group of people, intimately involved with a very large group of people. Now, after all these years, I've had the same friends for decades. We've been through a tremendous number of things together. From fairly early on, in my mid-20s, Swami Kriyananda put me in a position. First, I was running the kitchen at our meditation retreat, which was, because you've been there, which was only the seclusion retreat at that time. But the kitchen mother is also the place where everyone comes, and things were run very informally then. You know, we didn't wear hairnets, you know, and so the kitchen was where everyone hung out. So the kitchen mother, of course, was a big chatterbox for the whole story. So I've just always been sort of talking to people. Somebody who read my palm once just looked at my hand and said, "You had to be a counselor. There was simply nothing else you could have done." And it is sort of a feeling and an interest of mine. But I never finished college. I never studied psychology. But I've been counseled my whole life by Swami Kriyananda, who's probably the best counselor in the entire universe. So a great deal of what I'm going to tell you will be because both of what he has articulated from time to time when he's spoken on the subject, and what I've both observed and experienced in my own life. And Marlene might not know, but I've written a book for my own firsthand experiences and other people's experiences with Swami Kriyananda, which actually could be titled A Book on How to Counsel, because what it is example after example of his extraordinarily sensitive way of bringing the best out of others. So I highly recommend that. Some of you I know have already read it, but reading it just from that point of view of how to counsel, it's a handbook, because that's what his genius has been, is to understand how to bring the best out of people. So I'm going to just talk about, just from the beginning, sort of how I would try to explain to someone what I learned from him how to do. Because there's just, you know, a few of us here, this can easily be a conversation that I'll just give you opportunities to interrupt me with questions. And we can go any direction, and I'm sure everything we have to say will come out. Okay? The first aspect I would think about being a counselor is something, again, that I always have to say I've learned from Swamiji. He never thinks of himself as the person who's going to help people. He's never had the self-image in his mind, even though it's a self-definition that would be entirely justified. But he never sees himself as in a position to help other people. He sees himself rather in the position to enthusiastically share with people the great blessings that have been given to him. You know, he feels as a direct disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda that he has this obligation to represent his master and to pass on to others that teaching which was entrusted to him. And if anybody is interested enough, you know, if anybody happens to want to know what it is that the master gave to him, he feels extremely honored to be able to represent it. And I never really thought about myself. I've had to work myself into the right attitudes over many years. But over time, that's exactly, just speaking very specifically for me, but you could put whatever qualifications you have on it. I just feel like if I've been fortunate enough to learn a few things that have helped me, it's both my divine opportunity, my obligation, in the principles of Ananda that Swami articulated. He calls it the way of Ananda Sanghi. Sangha means fellowship. It's actually that little brochure in the plastic right back there. The way of Ananda Sanghis. What the first principle describes the fact that this universe is one behind this whole universe is one reality. That reality is called Satchitananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy. In other words, the foundation of the universe is bliss, as since we are all part of that same reality. As he describes it, we are bound to each other by bonds of mutual service, which I absolutely love. So the idea in relating to anyone in a formal or informal counseling situation is that this is a mutual exchange of energy. And even though, in fact, it may not be a completely egalitarian exchange, you know, in the sense that you may have something that person is coming to you even, I mean, it may be set up in such a way that the person is coming to you for something. If you think in terms of this all just being mutual service, it helps take out of your mind the idea that, oh, I'm here to give and you're here to get. Because any relationship that starts out like that is never really going to go anywhere. Because even if the person hears useful things from you, if they feel even slightly demeaned by the experience or put into a subservient role, now, if the individual, as a result of your exchange of energy, of their own accord, feels a sense of gratitude, that for them you see as an expansive experience. To feel gratitude is a raising and a refinement of our consciousness. So if, as a result of their relationship with you, they feel grateful for what they may have received for you, that lifts them. If, as the result of your attitude toward them, they feel they learned something new, but they feel demeaned, like I was ignorant and now this wise person has told me something, then they walk away diminished from that experience, you see. So you can end up in exactly the same place, but you can arrive there by two entirely different means, and that's what makes all the difference. Because the other part of counseling that is so just beyond important is no matter how messed up or hopeless or chaotic a person's life is. I have a friend who got himself into so much trouble. You know, just a whole series of events, and he ended up in this, you know, lawsuit that was a false lawsuit, but the other person was fraudulent, and the time period ran out, and then this terrible financial judgment was rendered against him, and there, even though the judge knew it was fraudulent, there was nothing he could do about it, and as a result, all these hard things have happened. So I called a lawyer friend of mine, and I was talking to him. He's a criminal defense attorney, so he's seen it all. And I said, you know, so this man and then this and this. And he said, well, okay, I'd be happy to see him. Of course, he'll need to bring in his financial records for the last 10 years. I said, oh, I forgot to mention, his house burned down. And the attorney said, of course. Yeah, just, of course, I love that response. Of course his house burned down. I mean, it wouldn't be right if it hadn't. So even if, you know, people come to you with a picture that is just beyond the beyond, you have to always have a tremendous amount of respect for that person to get themselves out of it. You know, that they can get themselves out of it. And there's a divine reason why they can get themselves out of it. It was their karma. And it would not have happened to them if it wasn't the natural progression of their life. Now, it might not be the natural progression of your life. It might even seem like a horrifying, unbearable progression of life. But it's their life, and so it's not going to feel as alien to them as it may look to you. Do you see? I learned that lesson with my parents when my parents were in the last years of their life. My mother was struck with Parkinson's, which she had for the last 15 years of her life. And Parkinson's is an extremely impressive karma. It's a very, very tough karma. My mother fought like a tiger, and in retrospect, she herself even said that it was the making of her, because nothing had ever challenged her like that did, and she fought really hard against debilitation, against limitation, and it wasn't always fun for me, because sometimes she was fighting against me, but she was fighting appropriately against me in retrospect. And then my father, because it was a very difficult thing for him, the last 2 years of my mother's life, he just went on what I called just a he went on holiday, and he just allowed his mind to just disconnect. He lived a few years after her, but he just couldn't really take it anymore, and he could see where my mother's illness was going, and he just had it. So he went kind of into this cheerful, relatively cheerful, slightly demented state, actually pretty cheerful, fortunately. So there they were, and my mother had a, my mother was very, 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 very self-willed, strong-willed, which I both respect and wish she wasn't at times. But the context of their life, you know, the what I perceive to be the slight disorder of the house, you know, just a certain dishevelment began to set in, and just all kinds of things happened. Plus, what my mother was having to face in her physical body, and my father in his mind. I just, for a long period of time, my entire attitude toward them was to make it stop. Mm-hmm. And then one day I realized that I wanted it to stop, not out of any sense of their welfare, but because it was so inconvenient for me. And then I stepped back and realized, this is how it came to me. You know, my parents by that time were in their late 70s, early 80s, that they had walked into this karma a step at a time. You know, it wasn't like, see, I kept looking at it like, here I am, Asha, living this life, and I just imagined myself just sort of being dropped down into one of their bodies and living inside their reality with no intervening steps, just being taken from here to there, which of course would never happen because that's not my karma. I'm walking in a different direction. And I realized that what was happening to them was the perfect fulfillment. It was the end of their journey. And it wasn't, it didn't feel as strange to them. You know, naturally, when my father was in the in-between stage of losing his awareness, although fortunately it happened kind of fast. He had sort of some kind of an incident, and I think his brain was oxygen deprived. And from that point, he was different. So in a sense, there wasn't a lot of in-between. That's the worst for Alzheimer's, when they still remember who they used to be and they're not quite that person. So it was great. It was the grace. But it doesn't matter. They, what was I going to say? Oh, it was the right situation for them. It was what their souls wanted. And it was the only way they were going to grow to their next step. And all of a sudden, I shifted my prayer from, I had actually just been praying that they leave their bodies, because in my world, death is not a tragedy. It's just time for an astral vacation. Let's just get out of this broken machine and, you know, just go on to the next phase. To my mind, I couldn't see any purpose in their going on. And I finally said, oh my God, how arrogant is that? You know, how do I know what their souls really need? I mean, how do I know? Maybe this is the most important, and I really think it was for my mother, maybe this is the most important part of their whole life, is to face this kind of challenge and meet it. Who am I to say?
But just, it still hurt you inside.
It didn't actually, Sharon, because let me finish this. Because why would I object to their learning what they need to learn? I mean, I'm trying to what? I'm trying to baby them? I'm trying to think they're too weak to face their own karma, that they can't suffer and triumph, that they should not get the consequences of their own behavior, that I should cut off their learning? I mean, if you have a child who does something wrong and you protect them from the consequences of their behavior, is that love? I mean, that's not love. That's how to absolutely ruin your children. Oh, I'll go to the judge. I'll get you out of the problem. I'll pay the debt for you. I'll fix it for you. We'll hide it. We won't
enablers.
Tell mommy. Yeah, enablers. And that's, you know, psychically, that's what I was doing with my parents. I was trying to have them skip the consequences of their behavior. Now, part of their karma is they had me. So it wasn't like I should just wash my hands of them and let them fall to the ground. But instead of trying to force my concept of what should happen onto their reality, I started trying to understand their reality and facilitate it. You know, facilitating their reality means that, oh yes, Mom, I can take care of that. Yeah, I can go to the lawyer. We can deal with this. I'll go help you find a place that you can move into. Yes, I'll help you shop for furniture. I would facilitate them. But that was quite different. And it was almost primarily in my inner attitude. Now, I'm talking about elderly people. But you see, anybody that comes to you, one of the most important counseling lessons I learned, now, because most of my counseling is not done with strangers. I mean, I have been at different points in my life. I mean, let me phrase it differently. I often counsel people I don't know well. And when I used to travel, and when I do travel, I often counsel people I've just met. So it's not like I never sit with someone whose life I don't know. But the other half of the experience I've had in my position here is that I have long relationships with people over long periods of time, people who are my neighbors that I'm living with. So because I have a lot of willpower and energy, I used to a much greater extent than was appropriate, take over people's lives. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't take it over even as a boss. I would just take it over, not even as an enabler, but just help them. You know,
manage
I manage it because
yeah.
I'm extremely good at other people's crises. This is
Well,
no, I just even if I'm not having, I'm just really, really good. I'm very reactive sometimes, but then when there's a real crisis, I just become as cool and as calm as can be, and I can really help people through their crises. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's a great grace, but I realize that I would have this inclination to just get too involved, and I sometimes people would say that to me, but I never understood it as anything but a virtue. Well, you know, I'm just a giving person, and I never felt martyred. You know, or anything like that. I don't have the willpower, I say, to be a martyr. but there was a quality inside me that it took me a long time to figure it out, and this is how it finally came to me. I'm going to put a little editorial remark in here. You must understand yourself in order to be able to help others. You know, the degree to which you get mixed up helping others is always because you have not paid attention to the first example, which is you. You know, often you can actually tell what's wrong with you by how you continually counsel others. You can sort of begin to see what your own inclinations are. We'll come to that in a few minutes. If I forget it, remind me. But what I realized is, because I have spent many years developing great faith in God, and because by the grace of God, I have a lot of faith in God, I don't really sit around in fear what might happen to me. I just assume that whatever God sends me, I'm going to be able to deal with. I have lots of tools. I have strength. And more than that, if he sends it to me, I'll be able to deal with it because it will be my karma. And if it's my karma, then there will be the appropriate strength in me because that's the divine law. I mean, fortunately, and I hope for all of you, at least theoretically, you can say that.
That's good.
Okay, so if it's the divine law and it comes to me, I can handle it. And I finally realized that I had this massive disrespect for everyone around me, because I thought that they couldn't handle their own karma unless I rushed in to help them. Do you see what I mean? And I was also, come on in, Anna. And I also had this, that's enough. We just need, there's plenty of room now. And then I had this fear of their suffering. And I thought, just again, how rude that is. How completely rude that I think that they're too weak to handle their own lives. That doesn't mean they don't weep and break down at times. I mean, we all do. But, you weep, you break down, you stop crying, and you get up, and you go on. As someone said very wisely, it's just not that easy to lie down and die. Even though you might try, it just doesn't happen. You know, you get hungry, and then you have to go to the bathroom, and then you're out of bed. But, so, people, even if they struggle, and even if they need you to hold their hands, you have to really respect them. And I realized that a lot of my over generosity with my time and energy was actually based on that I was afraid for them. And I thought, I'm not afraid for myself, not because I'm particularly powerful, but because God sends us what we need. So why would I be so anxious about the fact that God has sent someone else what they need? Just because it looks different than mine, maybe even looks extreme on a level I can't even imagine, but it's theirs. It would never have come to them if it wasn't true. So all of that completely defines, and this holds completely true for your children too, and it's a very important thing to realize, merely because they're young, inexperienced, maybe even callow in their inexperience, nonetheless, they're not new souls. You know, don't be so presumptuous. Nor is their life really, with all due respect, molded by their parents. It can be influenced by the parents, and it's an important karmic job for the parents. But those children have their destiny. Mm-hmm. And you're there to facilitate their destiny just as you would be any other soul. There's a unique relationship if they're young, especially when they're young. When they get older, the relationship becomes more like any other relationship of adults. And you have a special responsibility. All of that's true. But still, they have a karmic trajectory that you're trying to understand and facilitate. And as we progress, I'll talk more about how you try to tune into that. And why be anxious? I mean, often we're anxious because it's painful and inconvenient for us. Wow, that's a real generous motivation, isn't it? I don't like what's happening to you, so I want to have it stop. Like, who are we helping? You know, that's what I was doing to my parents, and that's what a lot of people do to older people. And it takes the control away from them and infuriates them, Marlena.
Did you feel like when you were fixing your parents uh-huh. that you were actually fixing yourself? Or that you were dealing with an issue that maybe you had? Is that what you're...
To a certain extent, that was true. Okay. To a certain extent, it was by that point in my life, it was less... I mean, the issue with me...
It was like a reflection of something that maybe was within you that...
Less so. The issue within me was more just simply... that I didn't respect people enough.
Oh.
I mean, it could have been other things.
Yes.
But it wasn't in that particular case. Let's just talk. I mean, yes, sometimes now, you see, what happens is, let's say, for example, somebody is inclined to be greedy, and you have a tendency toward greed in yourself that maybe you haven't fully admitted, you haven't come to terms with. Mm-hmm. So the psychology, the way it'll work is, because I have this suppressed inclination toward greed in me that I'm ashamed of, the way I'm going to get rid of that is to try to get rid of all greed anywhere it exists on the planet. So if you have greed, I have this compelling need to expunge your greed, because then no greed will exist anymore and I'll never have to deal with it in myself. Now, that is a very common thing that happens, and that is whatever you see in others that triggers in you anxiety, an anxiousness to expunge it, you know, an uncomfortableness with just seeing that it exists, mm-hmm. is always a sign that you have that quality in yourself. Now, otherwise, you can look at people's qualities and you just feel compassion and interest in them. It doesn't create an agitation within you. You can see it, you can see that it's wrong, you can see that it's not helpful to them, but you don't feel inwardly agitated about it. When it makes you agitated, you know it's unresolved karma of your own. Okay, go on with that.
When you use the word quality,
uh-huh.
and in my mind, I'm not going to think that anymore because that's an awesome word, quality. I think of, they have a problem.
Right, very good. That's a very good...
It's a problem, and you're looking at it
yeah.
as a quality because there are, you know, two sides to every coin. I mean, there's...
Right.
You know, being, I'm trying to think of something, you know, where, you know, there's this one quality, which is, looks like it's a bad quality, like controlling, but really, if you look at it as a positive thing, it could be being assertive.
Well, the way, this is the
you
way,
know, I mean,
yeah,
you know,
it's
so
exactly
I like
right. Quality is, well, here, now, at the same time, it's not helpful necessarily to not have any common sense. People can have unhelpful qualities. They're unhelpful qualities in terms of they're not ultimately happiness producing. And you see, all of these are objective, observable facts, but they don't bring with it all that load of anxiety on your part, judgment against them on the other. But still, you're calling a spade. You know, your tendency to drink too much is a very unfortunate quality. But it's just an unfortunate quality. It's not anything but that. Swami Kriyananda gave me that word. I loved it. I talked about, there was this woman who was, well, the only word I can describe her, she was unbearable. And Swami remarked, yeah, she does have an unfortunate manner, is what he said about her. And I loved that, an unfortunate manner. And it was unfortunate because it caused her to be isolated from others. It caused other people's feelings to be hurt. It was a very unfortunate quality.
Well, and you put it seems like you would put, you'd put the person down and you're not lifting them up.
Right, exactly.
It's a quality. Mm-hmm. It's an unfortunate quality. Instead of saying, oh, you have a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, and then you're just emotionally and, you know, subconsciously putting
exactly.
Down.
And almost always, and we'll before we're done, we'll deal with this, almost always people are aware that it's an unfortunate quality. You know, some people are so blind to their own nature, and you have to be very careful about that. But some people are so blind to their own nature that when you point out to them that they have two eyes and a nose, they feel suddenly extremely judged and hurt. But that's another question. Most people, if they're telling you that this has caused them a lot of trouble, and you say, yeah, that is an unfortunate quality, they can handle that because they've just told you that it's causing great grief in their life. But you don't want to be telling people things they'd never thought of for the most part, but we'll go there in a minute, okay? Is that good?
You
had your hand up too, sure.
There were two things I thought uh-huh. while you were talking. One is the teachings of there's only one. There's only one consciousness.
Right.
And that we are growing as individuals within that one consciousness.
Right.
And how we relate to other people. And a reflection of maybe, you know, what's inside of us that we're dealing with, or maybe not.
Right.
The other thing was, and kind of putting that in a perspective, and I think you answered that.
Uh-huh.
I'll have to listen to the tape again
okay.
to see. The other thing was that came to me was the teaching, the book that's read Sunday service, Judas.
What rays stop, of the one light?
Uh-huh. When he's just stop. So when
Judas stop.
Yeah. It's one of the, you know.
I know. Okay. Well, go ahead and see what you're saying, and I'll see where it
goes. Judas was doing a number of things, and Kriyananda's explanation was of that was just to stop.
Uh-huh.
Stop it.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of like the word repentance,
uh-huh.
Which means to turn around in your thinking.
Uh-huh.
So the point is that when you know you're on, everybody falls down and falls backwards and, you know, has to get up, dust themselves off, and keep going.
Right.
So. But recognizing when that is happening,
right,
and it's just like if it goes too far,
right,
then it's harder and harder to stop.
Well, it just momentum has to be reversed, right?
So anyway, those two things came to me about that and about Judas. Yeah. And so when I'm working or trying to help my brother, stop, just stop.
Oh, but you should stop helping him, or he should stop doing what's wrong.
He should
stop.
When you gave me advice one time, and it was kind of a universal thing.
Yeah.
Just do, you know, chip away at it.
Yeah.
Chip away at it.
Right.
Whatever it is.
Right.
And so when I hear him and I say, okay, it's too much thinking, just.
Actually, let's hold off how you should actually relate to your brother. I think it's premature for you to
draw.
No, I'm just saying it's premature for you to draw conclusions. So just hold the thought and let's wait till we're a little farther into the discussion. Because I have to say too many things in between to answer that. Okay.
And you'll probably cover it all
okay.
anyway.
Any other questions or thoughts here? Are we sort of established? So what we're talking about is.
I have one actually.
Yes, Edward.
You were saying when you push somebody. Should I ask you one? I was thinking already.
Well, just see if we can find it.
Uh-huh. I'll get back to this.
Okay.
I should ask you one.
No, that's all right. You can go like this and we'll start. If you can't hold it. All right. So what we're establishing is that we should consider it a privilege and a great duty. I mean, a great joy if people are at all interested in what we might have to share with them. And it should always be just sharing among friends, no matter what the formality of the relationship is. The key to that also is that word friend. Master talks a lot, Yogananda talks about friendship is the ideal relationship. He said, because friend to friend is the only relationship that is without compulsion. Because every other relationship that you have, I mean, the mother has to take care of the child, the child has to cooperate with the parent, the husband and the wife have assigned duties with each other, and they've made that commitment, and they're, you know, the expectation is that you'll keep it. A boss and an employee, a master and a servant. You see, there's a form to it. But friend has no form at all. And so, if you choose to make someone your friend, you may incur a sense of responsibility in that relationship, but it's entirely self-determined. Do you see? And so, therefore, it's the relationship of complete freedom. And so the ideal attitude to have in any situation, whatever the structure of it is that you're simply a friend. And that's how Swami Kriyananda, who has every right in the world to claim absolute obedience from people and, you know, to declare himself a guru who requires your response, has never related to anybody, even to this day, when people in India fall at his feet, prostrate themselves at his feet, he never considers him anything but a friend. And he does that because that's the best way to help people. Okay? And so when you're friends, even if the person is in trouble, you still have an essential sense of equality, and that was all that I was describing. That gives you your right attitude, and that tells you how to relate to them. Your friend may be in a weak state and need a little help. Your friend may have some unfortunate qualities, whatever it might be, but still, you're just helping them. Okay, so that kind of lays the groundwork for this. The other point that we did say, and we want to say it definitely again, there are laws of human happiness. You can call them divine laws, you can call them karmic laws, cosmic laws, anything you want to call them. But it is self-evident, and in our incredibly open-minded society, we actually try to pretend sometimes that if you make any judgment calls, that somehow you're wrong. Well, if you have a brain, you know that certain things produce positive results and certain things don't. And as a counselor, you mustn't be afraid to have common sense. And you mustn't feel the need to be so supportive that you can pretend that just anything goes and the results are going to be just the same. Now, bear in mind, and we'll, as we progress, we'll go through that, how you work with that fact makes all the difference in whether you end up actually being helpful or not helpful to people. But that simple fact is just there. Certain qualities make people unhappy and certain other actions don't. Now, the condition on that is that nobody is going to take your word for it, which is everybody learns from their own experience. And people are capable of perceiving the cause and effect relationship of their own actions entirely and only according to their own state of consciousness. And that's what spiritual growth is. Spiritual growth is an increasing awareness of the cause and effect relationships that are in place in this universe. You could call it increasing awareness of God's will, of divine law, of karmic law, or of just the way things work. I used to give a class called How the World Works and Why. Because after years of trying to help people understand that, I realized that's the name of the class, How the World Works and Why, which is what is karmic law and why does it make a difference? And it's not about a judgmental God and all of that. It's just the fact that if I pick up a sharp object, last night I was walking into my bedroom and I had been doing some sewing, and you know the great nemesis of sewing is that pins fall on the floor. And since you know ours is a shoes-off household, you know, and so I had subconsciously known that something had hit the floor while I was sewing, and fortunately I hit it, you know, just a little bit instead of dead on, and I was able to find the single pin that was buried in the carpet. I step on that pin, it hurts my foot. You know, it's not anybody's opinion. I could have all the positive affirmations I want. I put my foot down on that pin and it hurts. And it's really just as simple as that. If a person is consistently selfish and unkind and only self-concerned, the people around you will probably try to get away from you if they can. If in the name of trying to help them, you're really just trying to control them and impose on them your own values, they'll probably sniff it out and not be real receptive to you. If you say that you love them, but really you're just terrified that something's going to happen to them, and when it happens to them, it'll either inconvenience you or hurt you, so you act like you're trying to help them, but you're really just trying to save yourself the trouble or the pain, people will feel that. Okay, so it's like the fact is true, but I slipped into that other point of view, and forgot this for a moment. Yes, but it's very, very important to just be very comfortable with the fact that there is such, oh, I know what I was saying. People have to learn from their own experience. That's what I was going to say. And nobody can learn faster than they're capable of learning. And that's really a mantra that you just have to have. It doesn't matter how clear it is to you. It doesn't matter how self-evident it is. It doesn't matter how many times they've been through the same cycle. They will only learn when they're ready to learn. The Bhagavad Gita, which is the scripture of India, which has been revered for some thousands of years with extremely good cause. Swami Kriyananda just wrote, as you all know, the commentary to it, and I've been teaching it for almost 2 years now. We're almost finished. Everything in it, everything about life is in that book. And there's a verse where it says, it talks about three kinds of ignorance or three kinds of karma. It says, some karma is like smoke obscuring a fire. All you have to do is go, and the smoke clears and the fire blazes brightly. Some karma is like rust on a mirror. This is when mirrors were silver. And so the mirror rusts a little bit and you have to work a little bit. But you can get the rust off and then it shines clear again. And some karma is like the baby in the womb. And it doesn't matter how impatient you are, it's not going to come out until it's really finished. and ready to be born. Right? You can, you know, work as hard as you want, and that baby's just going to sit there until it's ready. So what that's saying is, that's saying that if a person is almost ready to understand something, all you have to do is just a little puff and they'll get it. Or if they're not quite able to, but they're interested, they can apply elbow grease to the mirror and they can clear it. But if they're like the baby in the womb and they're just not ready to know it, it really doesn't make any difference what you do. They're not going to know it till they're ready. And so when you're working with someone, it's extremely important. You may know that their behavior is not happiness producing, but the fact that you know it is so beyond irrelevant, I can't even think about, you know, how to say how irrelevant it is. There's a very important principle in counseling, which is called, we joke with each other about this because, you know, we're all in this, my big spiritual family, is called true but irrelevant spiritual advice. It's when somebody well-meaning tells you something that you know perfectly well is true, but what you want to say is, damn it, I know that as well as you. If I could act on it, I would be acting on it. You know, what you're saying is true, but it's entirely irrelevant, meaning it's not helpful right now. So even within ourselves, it's very good to have a phrase like that in your mind, because you may know what's true, but you have to ask yourself whether it's relevant or not. If you're looking at a baby in the womb that's not coming out, you can't tell him to pick up the cloth and rub the mirror. It's perfectly true, but it's not relevant to his situation or her situation. You see what I mean? And it's in the Bhagavad Gita. That's why I brought it up from there. It's in this scripture from Lord Krishna telling us, look, be realistic about this. This is part of the divine law. And it's even worse than not helpful. The way Swamiji puts it is, well, as he puts it very simply, timing is everything. If you tell a person something that's true before they're ready to hear it, they may feel the necessity to defend themselves against that. Because, pardon me?
Or punch you.
Or punch you. That the world you lived in, they would hit you, yes. I've never been hit by any of my counselees, but I can imagine it.
There's that one famous quote by somebody that says, after you tell the truth, leave town.
Yes, very good.
or make sure they laugh. If you tell somebody the truth, make sure they laugh or leave town.
Those are all very good. Yogananda, when he would lecture, Swamiji, when Swamiji first heard Yogananda lecture after he became a disciple in 1948, he was extremely surprised by how informal and jovial Master was, and how many jokes he would make, and how much he would make people laugh. And then Swamiji, who was very observant, began to realize that often after everybody was laughing, Master would say, slip in something very profoundly true, because everybody was so relaxed and open, there was no resistance, and then he could say what he wanted to say. Well, he relaxed them, and we'll talk about that in a minute too. You made them receptive. Okay. Because if a person is unreceptive and you hit them with something that's true, it's almost like, and this is a fact, it's almost like their soul has to defend them against premature knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know? Somebody who's very, very greedy, for example, you don't want to tell them, this is an extreme, you don't want to tell them, oh, life is all a dream and we're all one. Because then they'll say, fine, then what's yours is mine too, and what's his is mine, and the house over there, that's mine too. It's not really helpful information for them because they're not ready for it. And a lot of times, if you give somebody advice they're not ready for, they have to push it away because it's so far beyond them, it can make them feel discouraged, guilty, angry, all kinds of things. So untimely advice is worse than you think, because then it sets a resistance against that thought. And so even as they get closer to being ready for it, you'll have already spent your collateral. You'll have spent your credibility on it. It decreases your credibility and makes them less receptive to what you have to say in the future. So patience is everything, and timing is everything. This, again, I've learned from Kriyananda. Swamiji, he made a remark recently, this is in my book. He's now in his 80s, and of course many of us have known him since he was 40 or so. He really started doing the work of Ananda when he was about 40. So I think only a few people know him even in his 30s, but it mostly was about 40. And he said, He has started speaking more frankly in the last decade, more bluntly and directly than he has before. He said, he apologized to someone for correcting them sternly in front of others. He said, I hope I didn't hurt your feelings. He said, but I don't know how much time I have left, and I can't afford to wait like I used to. He said, I've been able to give someone some advice and then wait 10 years until they had integrated it and then say something else. He said, but I don't have that kind of time now, and I want to help you as much as I can. Now, that's his reality, but backing up from that, I would tell somebody something and then wait 10 years before I said something else. You see how completely selflessly concerned he is for the welfare of others, that there's no anxiety, there's no reason why he needs us to be different. He was giving a little talk for a fundraiser we did, and just telling us about all the spiritual reasons why we ought to give money to a divine cause and how much benefit it'll be. And at the end of it, he said, you have to understand, he said, I'm talking about this from your point of view. I'm explaining to you why it will help you to do it. I'm not talking about the fact that Ananda needs the money. You know, why would I say that to you? That would be just about something else. This is your point of view. So his entire orientation toward helping people is from the point of view of the person being helped. You stop and you use that slang expression, duh. I mean, what else would it be about? Except how often it isn't. And we imagine that we can help people just by blurting out things that they're not interested in hearing. Whereas the only way we can help them is that if in some way what we say to them looks to that person like their own next step. And my experience of Swami Kriyananda's absolute genius as a leader, absolute genius. I can't find words big enough. No matter who is sitting in front of him, he is so detached from any personal necessity to have anything happen that he can actually, that gives him the clarity of mind to actually know who's in front of him, which is something we're coming to also, actually know who's in front of him, and just very comfortably suggest what's right for them in such a way that they recognize it. This is my karma, and this would be my next step. Not necessarily your next step, or this person's next step, but it would be my next step. And so he fulfills the most fundamental rule of counseling, which is people should feel stronger and more optimistic after they leave your company. Because if after leaving your company, they're impressed with how brilliant you are, but that makes them feel discouraged, what have you accomplished? Right. Now, that doesn't mean you never speak sternly, but you have to be very, very careful about sternness. Because almost no one is helped by sternness. And the only way they're helped by sternness is if there is a very deep, long-standing sense of trust. You know, on occasion, Swami Kriyananda can be very, very stern, but he rarely is, because he simply has discovered that sternness does not encourage people as much as a sense of kindness does. But you can be kind and be extremely frank. In fact, Sister Gyanamata, who was giving us instructions for how to relate to the guru, she said, you can say anything you want to the guru as long as you say it with detachment and respect. And those two words, detachment and respect, are actually the key words for all relationships, but above all, a counseling relationship. If you're really speaking with detachment, which is to say, This is a good idea, but I'm not trying to make you do anything. I'm just trying to help you. And respect for that person's integrity and power and all the things I was talking about. But coming back, above all, almost everyone really knows what they're supposed to be doing next. You know, almost no one is actually so stupid as to not know what they should be doing. They may be confused. And in fact, in my own life, as I've gradually sort of become more, I would say, capable as a counselor, it's become more and more clear to me what it is I have to offer. And what I have to offer basically is clarification. Usually, almost always in a counseling session with people, I'll listen and listen and listen. I try to have as much open-ended time as possible. I'll just listen and listen and listen. And then somewhere, if they actually want a response from me, I will simply take what they said to me, and I will package it a little more clearly than they articulated it, and I'll just tell them what they just told me. And you know, it may sound like, oh, what an amazing thing to say, but it really was, I just told them what they just told me. I just said it a little more, I put the pieces together in a way that often when you're inside of things, you can't see. So it's just clarification of the knowledge that's already in them. Now, sometimes if people are hiding from clarity, you have to be very careful. Some people don't want things to be clarified, and you have to be very delicate with that. But mostly, you're simply telling people what they almost know, what they're ready to know. You're basically blowing on the smoke. And if you're doing more than blowing on the smoke, it's probably not timely. Because they have to say, uh-huh, yeah, that's right, that's exactly right. And somehow they have to feel when they leave, as I was starting to say, they have to have more energy and more hope when they leave than when they came in. Because think about your own life. When you're not able to go forward, and this is where self-understanding comes, not able to go forward and do what you need to do, it's very rarely because you don't know what to do. Or if you don't know what to do, it's usually because you're feeling so hopeless and depressed about it that you just can't see where you're trying to get. But when you feel stronger, then somehow your level of consciousness shifts and the doors just open, and yes, I know what to do. Or you need someone to hold your hand and be a cheerleader for you. Yes, you can. Yeah, okay, and then maybe help make a plan or whatever it is. But you're always moving with that person's energy, and this is what I was saying with Swami. And the thing about Swami, which I find amazing, is even if people are completely at odds with each other and have very strong feelings of differences of opinion about how something should be resolved, he makes everyone feel that he's on their side. Because he really is. There was one classic controversy when we were being sued by SRF, and we had to make the decision as to whether or not to go down and demonstrate at the SRF convocation, because SRF was keeping a secret from their own members how much money they were spending suing us, and we decided that if their own people knew, it would help turn the tide. It was beyond controversial within the Ananda community, that plan, because it was a pretty wacky plan. We were going to go down with picket signs to a spiritual gathering of our own gurubais, and it was, I smile because I was on the let's do it side, and it was fantastic. But there was so much opposition to it, very, very valid opposition. And Swami just remained absolutely neutral. He didn't tell us not to do it, but he never exactly told us to do it. But everybody who called him, and many people called him, he would say, well, I can really understand how you feel that way. And he really could. I really understand why you feel that way. And he would just help everyone move forward. And then he sort of stood back and let the thing play it out. And as it happened, we did it. And it worked. You know, but it was such a extraordinary example, because he was on everyone's side. He really could see why they felt that way, given who they were, given their orientation, given how they look at life. It made perfect sense to him.
Because he was detached.
And then, of course, he would help people deal with the reality of the fact that, you know, this seems to be happening, that other people feel differently. And he would just kind of try to find a way to work out all those points of view. But everyone felt that he could understand why we felt that way. I mean, even if in his own mind, I can understand you feel that way because you have all these complexes and that's naturally how you would feel. But he never added that. He would just say, I understand why you feel that way.
So we could have a whole other class on friendship.
Yes.
And how to be a good friend.
In fact, we could.
And boundaries and what to accept and what not to accept and when to be.
Well, this is a class in friendship.
Yes.
That's exactly what this class is. You know, friends give advice to each other and they're helpful. It's very well, very astute. That's exactly true. Yes.
Is there any hints that you can tell whether they're ready to listen to you or
Okay, that's a good question, because that's what's coming next, isn't it? No, that's exactly right, though, and that's right where we are.
Can I back up, though?
Certainly, Peter.
I'm wondering if there's hints that I can tell, because you touched on a lot of things. I hope this isn't too personal, but I've been going forward with a lot of truth for people when they're not quite ready.
Uh-huh.
And so that's my ego, I guess is what I'm asking. What's my own, you said you needed to know yourself first.
Yeah.
So that's my own unsettledness, that while I feel that I know this truth is so right and is what they need to hear, I lacked all those other things you just mentioned about timing and whether or not they're receptive.
Right.
So that really hit on some things for me.
Well, so what that is, and this is where we'll go now, then one has to ask the question, you know, do I really want to help people, or do I just enjoy? You have to develop a deeper and deeper sense of genuine desire to help people. And then you have to become, Master used this phrase to Swamiji, you have to become practical in your idealism.
So, and I was on my own agenda.
Yeah, you're on your own. You were not. Now, see, don't be too hard on yourself, Peter, because it was extreme, was extremely well-meaning. And you know, the kind of work that you describe doing is not a work somebody does for the glory or the importance of it. You would only do that kind of work out of a very sincere desire to help people. But it would just be a slight misunderstanding in your own mind about what is actually helpful. And it would just be this thought in my mind that if I could just explain it to them, of course they'll recognize the truth. And that was my own misunderstanding for many years, which some people in this room were the victims of it. And finally, Swami just, one of my friends said to me, she was wonderful. It took me 20 years to really integrate what she said. She said, "Asha, you explain my problems to me more clearly than I want to know them." Which is, she felt diminished by my clarity, not helped by it. Because she didn't want me to be so, and I was incisively correct and incredibly articulate. So I would explain exactly what she needed to do in the misguided thought that the only reason she wasn't doing it is because she didn't know it. That was my own misunderstanding with myself. I was very harsh on myself for many years. I just thought if I just kept bullying myself, I would straighten up. And one fine day I realized that I didn't like being bullied. And that when other people bullied me, it just caused me to burst into tears and become very depressed. And then I crossed my mind once that I bet people don't like this when I do this. And then I realized that people felt diminished after their contact with me, not helped. Timing and skill and detachment. See, I didn't understand myself. That's the only thing I can say. I thought that blunt truth is really welcome.
And that's kind of normal to think that way.
But if you pay any attention to what happens to you when people tell you the blunt truth, you would notice that
you
this...
You want to do what works, not what's right.
You have to be practical in your idealism. Yeah. See, you're not less idealistic. But you have to be practical. See, many, many people think that idealism alone is enough. And such people, you know, go through life, but they're not practical in their idealism. This is what Master Yogananda said to Kriyananda when Kriyananda was trying to convert a Jewish psychiatrist in Beverly Hills to this teaching, who was not even asking about it, by talking about all the miracles that Yogananda could do. And afterwards, Master said to Swami, "You have to be practical in your idealism. You know, you talk to that Jewish psychiatrist about miracles, he just thinks that you're trying to get an appointment to be one of his patients, you know. He doesn't think, oh, how marvelous, I think I'll become a yogi. He just thinks you're nuts." It's true, but it's not practical because it doesn't help them. And what are we here for? Just to, you know, blow in the wind or to actually help people?
So, feelings and emotion are not, emotions kind of run amok with feelings. But if you have pure intent with your feeling, come from insight.
That's where we're going right now. You keep pointing the arrows into where we're trying to get. No, that's exactly right, Sharon, but you're seeing. So what comes next after that? So, Peter, let's go on. Are you content yet or not?
He was saying about having a clue or a tip. So is there a way I can see in myself that I'm not interested in, like you said, we have to be interested in helping them. So how do I see that I'm on my own?
Okay, that's exactly where we are.
Okay.
That's where here's where we are. Do we need a break or should we just go forward?
No, let's keep going. Okay,
the story's too exciting. Okay. Okay, let's go on. The most telling sign that you're off balance is that if you're eager to say something. If you feel eager to say something,
well,
if you
find everything I've ever said.
No, but it's odd. No, that's right. That's good. That's good, actually.
And now you know.
No, if you feel eager to say it, if you stop listening and start waiting for them to stop so you can tell them something, if you feel this sort of slight sense of impatience, I've got to say this, you know, and now that's different, and this is a subtlety that you just have to develop between an inner sense that God wants you to say it, okay?
What if you think you're going to forget?
Then you should keep a little notebook in your pocket. No, I'm serious about it. You should keep, if you know that you're going to forget, have a notebook next to you and just jot yourself a note, because, or, see, sometimes you forget because it's not meant to be said.
Yeah.
And sometimes you forget because you have a sieve for a brain, but that's just, you know, the way we are. But if you feel any inner impatience, inner anxiety, you know, just too much enthusiasm that causes the attention to shift from their reality to you, then you can just be pretty certain that it's ego-motivated. Now, sometimes, now I have to put this in, sometimes you have to speak even if you're not perfectly centered. But if you know that there's an element of uncertainty about what you're saying, you're not certain how much of this is ego and how much of this is divine, then that causes you to be at least a little more cautious about things. And you don't just sort of blunder in. Okay? Another very simple fact is you should start slowly. This is an amazing thing that I personally learned. My brother in high school, in his junior and senior year of high school, was the Texas State debate champion. We lived in El Paso, Texas then. And he had a brilliant mind, a brilliant sort of argumentative mind. In my entire household, with, you know, my sister, my brother, and I, and my two parents, we never conversed. We only debated. And I didn't know until I was 50 years old, I'm now 61, the difference between debate and conversation. Yeah, the way we always conversed was that we would take turns presenting our best arguments. And it wasn't that we didn't take turns speaking, but the way we talked always would be, as soon as it was your turn, you would present all your best arguments, and then you would wait and see what the next person did. Now, this, of course, caused my brother to be a national champion, I mean, a statewide champion. But it's not the same as conversation. And so for my whole life, I would just, every time I had to explain something, I would debate it. I would start by presenting all my best arguments, and I could never understand why that was a conversation stopper. I would just expect everyone else to pull out their, you know, mental index cards and present their best arguments. And to me, see, I was always open to their arguments, but to other people, it always seemed like an argument. And I was absolutely bewildered. Isn't that just insane? And then finally, in the course of taking care of my parents in the last years of their life, somehow or another, something in the way we were interacting, I finally got it.